Okay, commercializing silicon on sapphire. Basically, I'm going to go through the history of the. I'm going to try to balance the entrepreneurial side of this with the business side. I have to admit, in the last 20 or 25 years, I have been much more interested in the business side of things than in the technical side. In fact, one of the reasons I started Peregrine was to explore personal ability as well as my personal interest in turning technology into business, into turning it into products, into making an impact with the technology. And so you'll see that I'm trying to mix the two things, but I prefer interactive. If you have a question, ask it. I think that if you're thinking of a question, there's probably half the room is as well. So this is kind of the outline. I won't spend some time on this, but I'm going to give you some. This is a personal set of opinions. I kind of have to say that because we're aspiring to go public, so by law I'm supposed to not say anything for the company, but actually this is what I prefer to talk about anyway. You're getting what you paid for, which is basically you didn't pay anything, so or you're paying a fortune, depending on how you count what your tuition is going toward. So I'm going to start out by at least giving you my perspective. Everybody has their own perspectives. One of the things my co-founder, Mark Bergener, taught me is you're entitled to your opinions. Doesn't matter. You don't have to rationalize them. You don't even have to explain them. You're just entitled to them. You have your own beliefs. You have your own opinions. And I think we've all been incredibly exposed to the personal side of Steve Jobs, who we all know just died this week, but who is the greatest serial entrepreneur in the history of the semiconductor business or high tech. In fact, I can only think of two other people who were successful serial entrepreneurs, and they did the same serial thing together, Bob Noyce and Gordon Moore. They started Fairchild when nobody knew what an integrated circuit was and nobody really knew what silicon was, and then they started Intel. Otherwise, almost every single major company that had an impact was a one-time success for that entrepreneur, for that founder. You really struggle to find serial entrepreneurs outside Steve Jobs. And then he just has, it's like he hit four home runs or five home runs in a row. And he had a strikeout in there, by the way. So, nobody's perfect. So these are a few kind of personal perspectives. In my opinion, it's a lot more fun to root for the Cubs than the Yankees. I like rooting for the long shots. The Cubs haven't won the World Series in 100 years. I used to be a real big Red Sox fan, but then they ruined it. They won the World Series. And my son and I actually were talking about this, and they said, someday we'd both like to see the Red Sox win the World Series, but we actually wanted them to wait until our grandson, my son's son, understood just what a long shot it was. Now, okay, Red Sox, they won a couple World Series. It's like they're kind of like the Yankees. Secondly, for those of you who are cartoon fans, I'm really much more interested in the Coyote than the Roadrunner. I think the Coyote is way more entrepreneurial, way more innovative, always coming up with these crackpot ideas on how to catch the Roadrunner. The Roadrunner is just fast. I mean, it just does what it naturally does, run away. Who cares? So third, my belief is that most members of a herd either get trampled or eaten. This is espoused by Bill Davidow, who, in my opinion, is one of the greatest founders of the Silicon Valley entrepreneurial experience, because Bill Davidow not only put together the marketing plan that became Intel, he formed Moore Davidow, and he wrote a book called Marketing High Technology. It's probably close to 20 years old, and I still think it's the best book on entrepreneurism, and it boils down to a really simple sentence: be different or die. That's what Bill Davidow believes, and that's what I believe, and it is exactly what Steve Jobs believed. You can be different and die, but you cannot be the same in entrepreneurial high tech and be successful. You will simply get trampled by people with more resources, greater access to capital, already been there, etc. So this is essentially my version of Bill Davidow's edict to the entrepreneur: be different or die. In other words, I'm an absolute dedicated card-carrying contrarian. I don't really believe most of what I've read. I believe there's truth in there, and then I think, you know what, there's also an opportunity for improvement, which means there's missing things in there. I can remember the moment when Mark Bergener walked into my office when we were at the Navy Labs, and he literally announced, and both of us were stunned, that all of the classic explanations for silicon on sapphire were completely wrong. This is, and I'll show you, this is all the great companies in this industry tried to make silicon on sapphire work, and they all failed. They spent hundreds of millions, close to billions of dollars to make this silly technology work, and they were all wrong. And Mark Bergner and his little research setup, which would have fit on this bench, figured out the technical truth of it, and once we knew that, then we knew how to make this a viable technology. Now, these chips are in everything from handsets to satellites. We are at every planet in the solar system. We've gone to asteroids. We've gone to we've been on the things that collected the dust behind comets. We're in 500 million cell phones. We're in every base station. Our chips are literally everywhere. So, what's this talk worth? I already kind of talked about it. I decided to start Peregrine in 1989. I asked Mark Bergner if he wanted to join me. I asked my wife, who's really the co-founder. The talk went something like this. I've been working in the government for 20 years. I am completely tenured. They couldn't fire me for anything except fraud and abuse. I have 6 weeks of paid vacation. I have a guaranteed pension. And I want to start a company on a technology. We had just bought a new house, and we had two children entering college. And I expected my wife to respond by saying, would you go over all those highlights again? But instead, she said, if that's what you want to do, that's what we'll do. I asked Mark. We were on a run. We've run together for 30 years or so. And he said, I have to check with my wife. The next morning, he said, I'm in. Now, what does this mean? And the honest truth was, we didn't know. It was an odyssey. We just didn't know what this meant. After our second round, we'd raised a total of $4 million. Since then, we've raised another $200 million, and we've spent 20 more years. Things happen. The technology worked. The technology actually delivered more than either Mark or I ever thought it would. And still, it took 20 years. And very, if you add the paid-in capital to all of the revenues that we've turned around and spent on the company, there's been about $500 million put into this company to get it where it is today. And today, it's in literally everything important that has either a wire or a cable sticking out of it. Our chips are literally everywhere. We are changing the way the world communicates with this technology. But it was a long, painful process. Honestly, if I'd have known it was going to take $500 million when I started the company, I would have said, there is no way you're going to get that kind of money. But thank God we didn't know that then, or we wouldn't be here today. So if you're still interested in that, then there's three kind of simple rules I've discovered about kind of entrepreneurial relationship between business and technology. First of these, capital comes with instructions. We talk about this thing called capitalism. Why don't we call it profitism? Why don't we call it jobism? Why don't we call it socialism? We call it capitalism because capital is the root energy in this system. Capital is not money. Capital is a chunk of money that is being taken from people who earned it in the past, and it's being given to the entrepreneur or the business for the purpose of creating more in the future. It's actually a time transformation. Capital is the transfer of wealth from the past to the future. And in order to do that, it always comes with instructions, whether it's a business plan, whether it's a purchase order, whether it's a funding check, whatever you have to do to go get that capital, that's the instructions. And believe me, the instructions are clear and they're ruthless. Everything takes about pi times longer, and it costs about pi times as much as thought. I can't tell you how many times that's almost, it's not exactly 3.14, but it's across the board, it's the human experience. And this isn't just saying, oh, I'm being overly optimistic. It's what happens. It's just something always comes up. Ask people who've refurbished their kitchen. How long did you think it was going to take and how much did it cost? And you'll find in the end, it probably is, oh, we're going to have an opening house party in 3 months. No, they're not. I can't tell you how many times it was 9 months or a year. And it was, oh my God, we didn't know that there were rats in the walls and this was wrong and we violated code and we had to this, that, and the other thing. So just do your best estimate, but have it in the back of your mind. This is going to take way longer. I thought Peregrine would be dead or successful by 1995. About 6 years. Guess what? It's taken about 20. And finally, this one is a kind of an interesting concept, but information only has value when it's in motion. If I know the cure for cancer and I tell no one, I don't start a company, I never write it down, and I keep it to myself. When I die, that information, as valuable as it seemed, it was worthless. So this is what drives people's desire to have good organizations, to communicate things well, is the information you have, in my opinion, is worthless if it isn't in motion. And that's what, and then there's a corollary to that, in my opinion, which is information has more value the faster it goes. And that's what the internet has done. That's what the that's what all these smartphones have done. The ability to get at information quickly is what is driving, that's what made Stephen Jobs literally, I think there are heads of state that could have died that wouldn't have gotten the attention that Steve Jobs did. So let's look at the semiconductor business. That's what Peregrine is in. That's the one business that I can talk about. I won't say I know much, but I can talk about it. This is the market segment. This is not that far off from what it looked like when I started Peregrine. Number one was Intel then. Number one is Intel now, and they're about 12% of the whole market, these things, semiconductors going into PCs and computers. Number two is now Samsung. Number two used to be whoever, STMicro or somebody else. The next eight comprise 50% of the total market. Who's in the next eight? STMicro, Qualcomm is in there. I think they're number eight or number six or something like that, fabless companies. So after that, everybody else constitutes the other half. If we look at it, what is the industry? It's about $300 billion last year. Walmart was bigger. Walmart was actually quite a bit bigger. So why does anybody care about the semiconductor business instead of just selling blue jeans? You can get more revenues out of Walmart than you can out of the entire semiconductor industry. The reason is semiconductors represent between 2 and 10 or 2 and 20% of the system content. So if you look at a cell phone, the chips inside are only about 20%. What else is in there? Screens, batteries, software. Same thing for a network, Cisco, or anything that's made up of electronics, only about 2 to 10% of it is the actual chip value inside. So that's about between a 10 and 50x multiplier effect that the systems are worth so much more than the semiconductors. And then you use those systems for 10 years. Cisco sells a network switch, and that network switch then sells internet services, et cetera. Your cell phone, the cost of the cell phone is a fraction of what you pay for the services over the time that you have the cell phone. When you add all that up and multiply it up, the semiconductor business is the absolute fulcrum of an industry that is somewhere about $10 trillion. That's easily the size of the oil business, which is the only thing out there that's comparable that I can find. So this is a very, very, very highly leveraged industry, and it's one of the reasons I was attracted to it, because if you can make a better chip, you can influence. It's a fulcrum that has a huge throw on it. So this is what's in there, microprocessors. That's that Intel piece, but there's other things. Qualcomm would be in a microprocessor in this analysis. They're a DSP. The other people, Broadcom, et cetera. Intel's trying to get into the non-PC-based stuff. Analog and discrete is actually pretty small. Most of the discrete stuff is like power, you know, things in your cars and power FETs and things. Those things have been around forever. They will be around forever. There's no substituting for a 50-volt, 50-amp MOSFET to drive a motor. It's just, look at what's in a hybrid car today. It's heavily big power electronics. So if you look at what's Peregrine in, it's in that kind of piece of that analog that's RF. Why did we get into RF? Mark and I believed in the RF market for CMOS when we started the company in 1990, when RF CMOS wasn't a tag word. In fact, mostly we were looked at with, are you stupid? Nobody does CMOS for RF. And besides, RF is a dinky-dinky market. It's only the military. We saw the cell phone coming. In fact, at times we thought we were too early. Times we thought we were too late. But we saw an opportunity, which was the world is going to switch from a computing-based world in the 1990s to a communications-based world in the 2000s and the decades beyond, and that's exactly where we are today. So now it looks like a pretty smart idea. I wish I'd kept all the emails of, you got to be crazy. So here's the multiplier effect. You can see, I mean, everything you around us today. I have a two-year-old grandson. I have a picture of him sitting in his diaper and playing on his mother's iPhone. He can actually change. He will take his mother's iPhone. He sees that there's a picture of one of his brothers as the wallpaper. What do you call it? The opening slide. He can actually change and take his brother out and put his picture in. He's two. I can't do that, but he can. So there's an entire generation of people who are coming under, basically being raised under the assumption that all the information available in the world today is available to them anytime they want it at a price that they don't even think about the cost. How many of you text and think, "Ooh, I'm gonna worry. Oh, gee, that's gonna cost me too much to send that text." There's no way. We have become a completely communications-based world, and you can see everything from the Arab Spring to the accolades for Steve Jobs, that computing is simply an implement for driving communications, which is what really drives the value of UCSD, is this entire communications-based view of the world. So I mentioned the oil industry. I happen to love the oil industry. Most people hate it. They take away the oil industry, and we'd still be, New York City would be somewhere between 10 and 50 meters deep in horse manure. The car was actually the solution to the pollution problem back when cities were just literally drowning in horse mess. None of this would exist. Computers wouldn't exist if you didn't have cheap energy. But it seems like the complete antithesis of the nice, clean, high-tech, ethereal semiconductor business, and then these grubby wildcatters and guys that go out and work with chains and pipes and mud. But they're very, very similar. The oil business and the chip business are dominated by the majors. They are dominated by the majors because they have access to capital and they have the scale to use it. A new fab, the fab just announced in New York, is a 450 millimeter fab, and most people are saying new fabs will cost $10 billion. That's B with a billion with a B. $10 billion, and its life expectancy is about 3 to 4 years when it's obsolete. You can actually have two deep sea oil wells for that. You can develop an entire 787 for $10 billion. And this industry, you have to put one of those up about every other month to support the production. It is incredibly capital intensive. Wildcatters are startups. They're the ones that find the oil. Exxon has a phrase, biggest oil company in the world. We find oil the old fashioned way. We buy it. They wait for an oil wildcatter to find a new field, and then they go buy the thing. They're not in the business of taking the risk any more than Intel or Motorola was in the business of coming out with a new wireless standard for cellular. A little startup company called Qualcomm did that, and luckily for Qualcomm employees and those of us here at the Jacobs School of Engineering, they didn't get bought out. They turned into the powerhouse of the industry, but it was a wildcatter that did that, not Motorola. And finally, you make money in niche opportunities. Unless you're huge, you don't make money selling oil. WD-40 is the place to be. That oil they sell, you don't like $100 a barrel, WD-40 sells for about $10,000 a barrel because it's a niche opportunity that nobody can compete with, and they print money. So what's the history? Where does SOS, where does Peregrine fit in? The first solid-state devices were called cat whisker diodes. They were used for in the early days of transmission. Little guys like Tesla and Marconi used them. And nobody knew how they worked, but if you put metal on certain materials like cadmium sulfide, it made a diode. Diode rectified things. Rectification is how you listen to radios. So the first field-effect transistor, everybody, oh, what a great invention. That's what Bob Noyce and Gordon Moore started Intel on. First field-effect transistor was patented in Canada in 1925. They had the go look up the drawing. It's incredibly correct. They just didn't know about silicon or germanium. They didn't know how to do it, but they had it right. It's an incredible realization that what I thought was invented in the 60s was actually invented almost 40 years earlier. A lot of things happened, a lot of entrepreneurs, a lot of businesses. By and large, the silicon industry has been entirely driven by entrepreneurs. There are no vacuum tube companies that turned into goods transistor companies, and there are almost no transistor companies that turned into integrated circuit companies. Just like there are almost no railroads that ever turned into airlines, and no buggy companies that turned into railroads. So the form of capitalism we have is, I think it's been called destructive replacement or something like that, but you don't see evolution, you see replacement, and that's true in this industry. In the 60s, there were some papers came out, and people realized that if you put an MOS transistor back to back, You could actually make a digital switch out of that, and it drew no current because one was on and one was off, no matter what you did. So the only time it drew current was when it was switching, which looked trivial compared to every other form of electronics. Remember, this is the dominant, this is the golden era of vacuum tubes. So the idea that you could actually do electronics for what looked like no power, DC power, seemed astonishing. The problem is it had all sorts of technical issues with implementing it. By then, silicon was around, but there were all sorts of technical issues. And then a guy right up the road here at Rockwell, then called Autonetics, realized, he said, gee, I wonder if we could put this on an insulator, we could keep these things from talking to each other, which was the biggest problem. And so silicon on sapphire was invented. And frankly, it was put into a number of companies because it looked like the obvious solution to a number of problems. It worked, it's fast, it's low power, it's actually easier to manufacture. The only problem was the yield was about 1/10 to 1/20 of the silicon yields. So if you're yielding at 1/10 or 1/20, then it's too expensive. Everything is 20 times as expensive. People thought it was expensive because sapphire was expensive. That wasn't it. That was 5% of the cost. The problem was the yield. And when I was working at the Navy lab, I was in the R&D center. And I like to think of it as I was sitting at the bottom of a pachinko machine called the Department of Defense R&D system. And somebody somewhere wrote on a little pachinko ball, what is coming after CMOS? This was in 1976. There wasn't a CMOS company in sight. But what's really interesting about this is the entire Cold War was fought by the U.S. saying, we're going to have smarter weapons and the Russians will have more. So what people don't realize is that at the height of the Cold War, the Russians had 50,000 battle tanks. We had five. But we had 100,000 battle tank killing missiles that cost 1/100 of the cost of a tank. And we said, look, as long as we have smarter weapons, they can build all the ones they want. And this was ultimately proven. I'm a military guy, but it was ultimately proven in the subsequent Gulf Wars. The technology overwhelmed the numbers just overwhelmingly. The flaw was that this was all based on CMOS. CMOS is here like many things, like railroads, like penicillin, like copper bottom ships. It's here because a military somewhere said, I don't care what the cost is, the performance is what I need, and I will pay for it. And they kept CMOS alive for 60s and 70s was the primary user until it finally came out in the late 70s that companies realized we have to get the power out. The 386 was melting the sockets and catching fire because it consumed too much power, and everyone was shocked. Well, oh my gosh, we have to switch to CMOS. It almost broke Intel. If you look at Intel's stock price, it collapses in 81, 82, 83. Why? They didn't have CMOS. They actually went to IBM, who bought 30% of Intel, gave them the CMOS technology, and then produced all the 386s for them, gave them the wafers, and bought them back for about 10 times as much. IBM saved Intel with CMOS. And then everything since then has been CMOS, and the military thought, oh, geez, if the Russians get CMOS, they catch us on technology. We're never going to build that many. What are we going to do? We need a new technology. That's what got written in that little pachinko ball, and tink-tonk, tink-tink, and the lights went on, and it landed on my lap, literally. What's after CMOS, 1976? I don't know. I know it's another form of CMOS, and that led to a search for a silicon-on-insulator that was manufacturable. What Mark and I did at the Navy lab was not invent silicon-on-sapphire. We made it manufacturable. It took us 10 years, probably took about $10 million, that only the DOD would put the money into. And at the end of those 10 years, Mark and I knew we could manufacture this at the same yields that we could manufacture regular CMOS in the Navy's lab. So that was, okay, if we can do that, is there a time now to go try to commercialize it? And that's what we did when we started Peregrine. So what is the technology? Okay, this is the universal technology slide. It applies to every field. It applies to every market. It's completely true. If you don't see whatever, if you want to be an entrepreneur, if you don't see your technology in the right place on this slide, keep looking until you do believe that. It doesn't have to be true. You only have to believe it's true. And there's two aspects of this slide that we have to talk about. So this is it. It's true for everything. If you believe your stuff is better than the other guy's stuff, you're halfway there. If you believe, and that doesn't have to be on every parameter, it just has to be on a key parameter. And if you believe their stuff is worse than yours on some other key parameter, you have the makings of a new company and a breakthrough option. Why do you want to be better than theirs? It's obvious. Why would anybody switch if you're not better? But the other aspect, reading the abscissa, is just as important. If there's nothing wrong with the existing technology, you will never break in. They will use you. They will delude you. They will tell you, I'm going to use it. And then at the last minute, they will tell you, okay, I'll use you, but you have to be cheaper. Okay, I'll break in. I'll give it to you cheaper. They then call them, and they say, we just got this quote from us, and if you don't match our price, then we're going to go with them. And of course, the existing solution says, I'll meet you halfway. I'll give you a price break. You're out. You never break in on price, ever. Good enough, cheaper is the road to disaster in a startup company. If you cannot explain what Steve Jobs could explain, this is a better experience. The iPhone is a better experience, and I'm going to charge you, the user, $600. In the same era, Nokia was saying, this phone's good enough, and you only have to pay $50. In fact, we'll give it to you for free. Who's dead? Not Steve Jobs. Which company is in trouble? Nokia, the man on a burning platform. I got news for you. The burning platform already burned down. They're swimming in the North Sea somewhere. They're not even number two. A year and a half ago, they were number one by 2x. They're not even number two anymore. They're barely number three. Why? Because good enough and cheaper was the path to destruction even for them. Can you say General Motors in the 70s? Think about Motorola, owned the cell phone business. FM radios, go talk to the old guys, the guys with gray hair like me. Go talk to an old Motorola guy, FM, that's the only radio you'll ever need. Digital radio, ha ha ha, manly laugh, ha ha ha, I'll never use a digital radio, ha ha ha. Guess what? Motorola isn't even alive anymore. Motorola Solutions was bought for an IP portfolio by a software company, Google. The company that founded this industry 20 years ago isn't even there anymore. Why? Good enough and cheaper. Path to destruction. The entrepreneur should never, ever believe in good enough and cheaper as a path to success. What about us? Why did we think we were better and the other guys had a problem? We had CMOS. In my opinion, I've started many, many talks. Hi, I'm Ron. I'm a CMOS-aholic. That's it. I processed my first CMOS wafer in 1973, and when I saw what it could do, I literally walked out of the lab and said, nothing can compete with this. Anything CMOS wants to do, it will. Why? Because you have immense design freedom to do almost anything, and it consumes no DC power. And power is everything. Power is what's driven this industry from day one. If power weren't important, we'd still have vacuum tube mainframes. But the power was killing people. The reliability was right there with it. So if you look at what we had CMOS. And we could leverage all the CMOS benefits, all the design capabilities, the manufacturing, those billion-dollar fabs. But we had a key difference. We had a sapphire substrate. So Mark and I knew CMOS is CMOS. In fact, CMOS today has commoditized itself to near irrelevance. How many of you are currently working on or thinking about working in the digital domain? Probably a lot of you. I have an exaggerated analogy I'm going to use, which tells you that's near worthless. You're walking down the streets, rainy night, you look in a gutter, there's a penny. Penny has some gum on it. Do you pick it up? Not me. That penny, you just didn't pick up 100 million digital transistors. That's what they sell for today. If that isn't worthless, I don't know what is. Obviously, you have to sell them by the billions and trillions to make any money out of it, and that's what people do. Memory, et cetera, these microprocessors are 50 and 100 million gates now, and then they sell software. So in the end, the digital market has literally commoditized itself to the point of it's obviously not irrelevant, but you get the idea. The value is in the analog, and today the value is in that RF front end. How are we going to get more bandwidth, more channels, and get it all inside that tiny little phone? Sapphire was the key because if you do silicon at RF frequencies, the silicon absorbs the very energy you're trying to generate, and more importantly, it distorts it. So with all these digital techniques, the CDMAs, WCDMAs, LTEs out there, they're trying to use Shannon's law, Claude Shannon, one of the early winners of the Nobel Prize, a rather astonishing list of people to be on, basically said you can get as much information down a channel as the noise will allow. So if you can get signal-to-noise ratio high enough, you can get more data through the same bandwidth, which is in short supply. So what we didn't know about this technology when we started Peregrine is it turns out the Ultra CMOS transistor is the most linear transistor on the planet. It's not us saying that. That's guys like Steve Moss, who's a worldwide renowned mixer expert. It's our products. We are the most linear thing out there. Linearity is essentially data rate. So if you look at the different technologies, so now we're going to kind of look at the different technology pieces. Upper right is what we do. Upper left is bulk CMOS. It's fantastic. The problem it had was, if you look at it, there's a PN-PN structure, which is the famous latch-up path. That's largely been taken care of by dropping voltages. If you look in the lower left, it's silicon bi-CMOS. You add it's got a bipolar and a CMOS transistor. Bipolars are fantastic. In fact, bipolar transistor is the best transistor ever given to us by nature. It has low noise. It has high gain. It's easy to match to. It's really a fantastic transistor. It has two key problems. It doesn't like to be turned on and off completely. It has what's called saturation. So you can turn them on quickly. You can't turn them off quickly. So you can't make fast switches. Well, what's a Pentium? 50 million switches. An inverter is a switch. A 3-input NAND gate is 3 switches this way and 3 switches this way. Digital logic are switches. They either go on or off. So bipolar is basically dead as a switch. So you say, okay, but gee, how many switches do you use in an RF front end? Almost everything is made up out of a switch. A mixer is a switch. A switch is a switch. A digital attenuator is a switch. A digital phase shifter is a switch. In fact, about the only thing, you can make power amps out of switches. They're called Class E. They're constant envelope. GSM used them. It's actually a great idea. They're very efficient. They're switching power amps. DC converters are switches. If you really tear things apart, there's only a couple of things that aren't switches. Low noise amplifiers, RF amplifiers, and to some degree power amplifiers. So in the end, being on CMOS with super linear switches is the value we recognized we had. So back to that universal technology chart. What was our advantage? CMOS, low power, high linearity, ease of integration, etc. Okay, now we know why we're better than the other guys. Who are the other guys? They were gallium arsenide, the lower right here. The gas guys had the HBT transistor. It's incredibly good as a power amp. But it has all sorts of manufacturing issues. It's not really good at integration. And it's not available from CMOS fabs. So we have a lot of our customers have told us, I want gallium arsenide out of my systems completely because it's great when it's good, and then we get 3 lots in a row that don't work right. They don't have the manufacturability of CMOS. It's incredible what the gas guys have done, given what they have. But nothing has ever received so much money as CMOS in terms of driving its manufacturability. So that's how we knew what we were better at, and we also knew what the weakness was in our competition. For those of you who are designers, this is what makes us linear. All that stuff on the right in that schematic is all the parasitics that come from that substrate. The PN junctions, they're what? Diodes. Diodes have a capacitance that goes as 1 over the square root of V. Take the third derivative of 1 over square root of V. What do you get? 1 over V to the 7/2. It never goes to 0. That means you'll always have a third order nonlinearity. Third order nonlinearities are the killers. Why? Because they take 2 tones here and they fold the mix back in. It's in band. You can't get rid of it with filters. So third order nonlinearity, that's why everything, what's your IP3, what's your this, it's always that third term, sometimes the second term. The key here is if you throw away all those terms, a MOSFET is inherently a square law device. I equals AV squared plus BV. Take the third derivative of that equation. They all go to 0. So there's no nonlinearity in this transistor at all. That's where that linearity came from. That's why ours was better than theirs on linearity. Thank you, Qualcomm, for needing that much linearity and LTE, because without it, you wouldn't need Peregrine. So the future of Peregrine was always integration. We felt, what's the first name of the integrated circuit? Integrate. Right? That's its first name. It could be called the dense circuit, it could be called the computer circuit, it could be called a lot of things. It's called the integrated circuit because that's what Bob Noyce and Jack Kilby, the inventors of the integrated circuit. Jack Kilby got the Nobel Prize for inventing the integrated circuit. That's actually, most people feel, oh, that's an engineering result. Nobel Committee said, no, this is an absolute technical breakthrough. Bob Noyce would have won, but he was dead. Unfortunately for the industry, in my opinion, the second greatest entrepreneur in this whole market segment was Bob Noyce, and he just died, unfortunately, young, kind of like Steve Jobs did. Nobel Prize only awards to living people, except I think this year one guy died 2 days before or something, so they made an exception. But that invention of the integrated circuit was Nobel recognition worthy. And the key is integration. Why? Because you can do more and more things inside, do less and less things on the outside, and you can control things. Why do these computers essentially represent mainframes? They're supercomputers of 20 years ago. Why? Because they're integrated, not because they're fast. There used to be called a 386. There used to be a thing called a 387. That was a processor and a coprocessor, a floating point multiplier. The coprocessor was on the rest of the board. It took 5 clock cycles, 5 wait states to get the data from the processor to the coprocessor. It could do the floating point in 1 clock cycle and then 5 more clock cycles to get the data back, 10 clock cycles. As soon as you integrate those, you take the 11 clock cycles and turn it into 1. The computer was 10 times faster in calculation, didn't have to go faster in clock cycle. Integration is what made these things what they are today, not just the technology. So if you look at this, and I'm not going to go through it, but basically these are all the different technologies used today in RF. I didn't put gallium nitride up here because it's just, I think it's a very, very interesting technology. And these are all the things across the top that you put in a radio. There's digital stuff in radios. There's mixed signal. There's mixers. There's low noise amplifiers, etc. If you go down, this is my personal assessment as to what is the value of each of these technologies. And you see I've tried to pick out best, although bipolar and bi-CMOS, they're both outstanding in analog because they have that bipolar transistor. For analog front ends and low noise things, you can't beat it. If you go down vertically, you'll say, gee, if I want to make the best system, I'll take the best technology, put it in a package, and I'll integrate it. The problem everybody from Steve Mollenkopf and even Paul Jacobs on down in the industry have said is the problem is the RF front end is so complex. It's so complicated. There are so many channels. There's so much demand on the performance of the RF that the RF is taking up way more area than the digital piece, which is now fully integrated thanks to 65 nanometer, and it's going to get better with 22 nanometer and then 16 nanometer and the disappearing gate digital. But if you want to integrate, and partially you integrate because the performance gets better, just like that 386, 387 turned into a 486 and the computer went 10 times faster, what happens when you start putting these different RF functions together and optimize the value in a single design? So you can get performance out of it, and of course you get size, and because we only have to handle one chip, package one chip, there's actually a cost of ownership, which says we get to sell a more valuable chip, and the customer pays less for the total footprint. If you want to integrate, then you have to go left to right. You have to pick a technology that you're going to integrate on, and then you have to look for the ones that can do everything. If it can't do everything, then it can only integrate the things that it can do. So a key thing, I already talked about how many switches are in a radio. People don't think about it, but it's incredible. The switch is becoming the most important part of the radio. If you can't do a good switch, it's not going to integrate. You're just not going to get there. If you can't do a good LNA, you're probably not going to get there, power amp, et cetera. So I'll leave this chart. I'll put these slides up. But basically, if you read left to right, if there's a red X, that part can't be integrated. You can never get to what we used to call the microcommunicator, like the microprocessor. How do you get to a single chip solution and deliver that to a customer that meets their needs? And the technology of choice, of course, in our opinion, is CMOS on an insulating substrate. The next best thing to us, frankly, is CMOS on silicon on insulator. There's some issues there, but it's actually quite a decent option. So what's the issue with the RF front end? The issue with the RF front end is voltage. When you have, I think I have the number here, 1 watt in 50 ohms, if you're lucky, you get 50 ohm match. That's 10 volts peak. But what happens if, people pick up their cell phone by the antenna and it's now got a VSWR of 4? Well, the voltage just went from 10 volts to 16 or 17 volts, and your chip, if it's seeing that, it has to handle it. So it turns out in an open, the voltage doubles, which means that 1 watt looks like twice the voltage, V squared, it's 4 times the effective power. We design our chips for 4 times the power that they have to handle, and that means we have to handle 20 volts. How do you handle 20 volts with a 3-volt transistor? We stack them. Anybody can stack them, right? Not on bulk, you can't. Bulk CMOS is a thing called the body effect. There is one of these transistors handles 0 to 3 volts, and the top one handles 17 to 20 volts, let's say. The 20-volt performance is very different than the 3-volt performance because of that body effect, because of the total voltage. It turns out you don't divide equally. You divide in a natural log way, and eventually you can't. Stacking does you no good. You can't handle these voltages in bulk CMOS or with any semiconducting substrate. So it has to be some form of an insulating substrate. That's actually how the gallium arsenide PHEMT people do it. They have thin field effect transistors on semi-insulating, it's good enough, semi-insulating substrates, and they use many of the same tricks. But if you can't do that, you can't handle the voltage. So what are you seeing? RF CMOS is used in transceivers at low voltages, but when you get to high voltages, you're either using gallium arsenide or something like us. If you can do everything, this is the idea. That circuit on the right is actually a chip that Kansas State University designed for a really cool experiment. NASA asked Kansas State, how could we make swarms of little helicopters for Mars? The idea was, could you make a radio-controlled helicopter that had enough smarts to keep itself flying, could take pictures and look around for crazy things like water trenches or fossils or any sign of life? If you could make them light enough, you could literally send out little swarms of these things. So they wanted a 10-gram complete transceiver with a 1-watt transmitter. Those people designed it. That was actually designed, and I still love the image of the project. I don't know where its status is, but the idea was if we could make these small enough, we could use a CCD camera, a little bit of smarts, and a 1-watt transmitter that could burst mode data out and cover lots of area instead of a rover moving at, what is it, one centimeter a minute or something. In 10 years, it's gone a half a mile. I mean, these things could cover enormous. I think it's another example of where integration is the only way you could possibly pull off something like that. Previous solution was about 200 grams because of all the packaging and assembly. So markets, I already talked about digital. We're in other. That's kind of that niche thing is where you make your money. What's driving the current success of Peregrine? It's data. It's all of you. It's all of us. Every time we say, find me an Italian restaurant, the cell phone system, the wired system, telephone took 100 years for data to pass voice in terms of its capacity, about 100 years. It was modems. It was Hayes modems and AOL and all that stuff. There was more data going down the wires than voice. The cell phone system made that transition in way under 20 years, and now it's about 5-1, and it's going to 30-1, data over voice. People are just using this system for data, and there's not enough spectrum around. So that gets to that whole linearity. It's everywhere. You have to make a good base station. You have to make a good handset. You have to make a good GPS receiver. You still have to make even police band radios, which we sell a lot of chips into. They're data driven. They want to type in a license plate and get, is this a bad guy or a good guy, et cetera. So this is our solution slide. This is ours versus theirs. We're better in these key linearity areas and in integration, and they're worse in things like manufacturability and an integration roadmap. So what does all this add up to? The basic truth is people are interested in the semiconductor industry because of the leverage and because of the capital it takes to get there. There's a moth and flame aspect to this. You have to have a good idea to attract the capital, but you have to have the capital to pull off the good idea. Which is more important? I've often used the analogy, imagine a corner of two streets. On one corner, the northeast corner, you pile up huge piles of money. And on the southwest corner, you pile up huge piles of engineers. Where do you think people are going to go? To the money corner or to the engineer corner? And the answer is, it's Willie Sutton's law. Why do you rob banks? Because that's where the money is. We call it capitalism. So the entrepreneur can bridge that gap to put those engineers and those scientists together with that capital available, and that comes in the form of either a business plan or a discussion. It's some kind of communication. You're communicating your information to somebody else, an investor, to start creating that company. When you do it right, look at Steve Jobs. Look at Gordon Moore. Look at Irwin Jacobs. Where did this building come from? He put this magic together. He said, I can make a better cell phone system, and believe me, you're going to need it. And there was immense pushback because CDMA was so hard. Everything had to be linear. Honestly, from a technical point of view, GSM is better. It's easier. It's cheaper. It just doesn't have the ability to multiply data rate per unit bandwidth like CDMA does. And so in the end, this was what created these buildings here today. Pi times longer. Basically, if you look at how long it takes to do these things, I already told you, Peregrine, it's at least 3, if not 4 times longer than I expected. Microprocessors take 7 years, more than that now, to develop, and yet they only stay in production for 3. So you're constantly in this production cycle and building new fabs. These are multi-billion dollar bets. It costs almost as much to develop a new microprocessor as it does to develop a new commercial aircraft like the 787. The chip business is relentless in terms of quality. We currently ship today less than 1 part per million bad chips into the cell phone market. It's about 0.2, which means we ship 5 million chips and we get 1 back. Meanwhile, Microsoft sells its new software, and it tells you there's 50,000 bugs, and it takes years to fix it. So this is anything in manufacturing is not for the faint of heart. Wireless has FCC regulations, which you have to comply with. You can get all the way to the end, and they'll say, oh, no, too much noise, etc. And then there's the what I call the pesky buyers, the buyers at the company. I have a phrase, I hope nobody's parents in here are buyers at companies, but all buyers are liars. That's their job. Their job is to tell you, I can get that same shit for half that price. I can get that anywhere. My engineers say they don't need it. They are negotiators, and they always will tell you that they can get the same thing or better at a lower price. You have to get past the buyers. One of the fatal flaws at Nokia, they turned the company over to global supply chain managers, sophisticated words for buyers. And they literally, you couldn't get a meeting through, they built an R&D center here, and you couldn't get in if there wasn't a buyer who approved you. If you had a new technology, if a buyer said, I don't want that company, you couldn't even talk to an engineer because the buyers ruled the company. Look where it led them. So the buyers, we have good buyers. We do the same thing on the buying side, but that's not where you do not win. The buyer doesn't let you in. The buyer keeps you out, and that's actually a very key thing to keep in mind. And finally, information has value only when it's in motion. That's what semiconductors do, so they're part of this value chain. That's your job as an entrepreneur, is to take your information and communicate it to the people that you need, whether it's co-founders, future employees, universities to say, gee, could we work together on this? The press is all part of that information flow. And if you don't know how to do that, you have to learn, or look at what Steve Jobs does. You can take an outline of any human being and put 2 white wires on it. What are they doing? They're listening to an Apple product because he was such an incredible marketing guy. It's just, guess what? Black wires are cheaper. Right? That's what most wires are. Every other headset in the world is black. Black wires. They got to be cheaper. They're higher volume. Steve Jobs pays whatever, a penny more for that wire, white wire, and he probably tied up the white wire guy saying, it's exclusive. I don't want you selling earbuds with white wires. And he did that because he was communicating, this is a different, better experience. And he ran ads that way. Outlines of people dancing with white wires. And they didn't have to say a word. So this whole idea of express your value in the form of communicating your information is what the entrepreneur does. And this is kind of Bill Joy of Sun. It's called Joy's Law. He's the one, he's got 2 great comments, great additions to the industry. One was, the network is the computer. That's Bill Joy, the co-founder of Sun Microsystems. And the other is Joy's Law, which says the amount of information in a network goes as the factorial of the number of people in it. Factorial is a huge number. 100 squared? Ha! Try 100 factorial. Now, does that mean there's 6 billion factorial? No, it's because, in fact, you're seeing inside the entire network. I don't communicate with all those Chinese people and all those Indians. I communicate with, whatever, 100 people. But the amount of information, if that goes to 105, the amount of information is just colossally expanded. One of the reasons everybody's trying to get rid of the reply to all button is because it's expanding to the point that it's swamping us. So that's it. I'm open to any questions or comments, and I appreciate your time and appreciate you standing up.